The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
What they want to do is transfer the money out from bank account to bank account, so taking it from the Maltese bank's accounts and sticking it in another account. For that, they need bank accounts. They need laundering accounts they can wash this money through. So they go back to Big Boss and say, hey, you know, can you help? And Big Boss says, well, no, but I know a man who can. And that man is Hush Puppy, who turns out to be an Instagram influencer with something like 2.3 million followers, who's in Dubai and by day is, you know, doing what influencers do, you know, eating in nice restaurants and wearing nice trainers. But by night is carrying out various money laundering activities, including, it then emerges, for the North Koreans. And that leads you to Hush Puppy. So these fascinating characters, this goes back to what Gene said, you know, the North Koreans are looking around the world for accomplices and people to work with. And frankly, they're finding some really weird people, but weird but useful people, because they do help them steal quite a lot of money.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for April 21st, 2023. Over the past decade, North Korea has taken on an exceptional global role, a sovereign state believed to be at the head of an unprecedented international criminal network, one that is particularly active in cyberspace, where the North Korea-backed Lazarus Group is believed to have been responsible for several of the largest and most audacious incidents of hacking, ransomware, and outright theft of the modern era. Journalists Gene Lee and Jeff White have been documenting the Lazarus Group's activities for the BBC. The second season of their podcast, The Lazarus Heist, is now available. I sat down with them to discuss how this second season built on the first, what the Lazarus Group has been up to, and what it all tells us about North Korea's position in the world. They also gave us permission to share a preview of the new season with you, which we'll play after our discussion. It's the Lawfare Podcast for April 21st, The Lazarus Heist, Season 2, with Gene Lee and Jeff White. Jeff and Gene, it's really great to have you back on the podcast again. The last time we had you on, we were talking about Season 1 of your phenomenal podcast, really one of my favorite podcasts I've listened to of the last few years, The Lazarus Heist. And we now have at least the beginnings of Season 2 out and about in the world on the BBC website and other podcatchers, although you get a sneak peek of a few additional episodes if you go to the BBC website. Tell us a little bit about how you went about conceptualizing this season. Last season, you all really focused on kind of building backwards from the WannaCry ransomware incident, contextualizing, going back to see the Lazarus Group, this group of North Korea-associated hackers and their involvement in everything from the Sony hack to ransomware, and then really use that to spin off and explore all sorts of interesting intersections with the story from, you know, the history of Korean expatriates living in Japan and other parts of the world, and their relationship with North and South Korea, to different aspects of cybercrime and different aspects of governmental activity. So given that really broad scope and interesting story of the first season, where did you guys want to pick up with this season? How are you structuring it similarly or differently?
Well, I think in a way, it was fairly easy. The proposition for me for season two was fairly easy in that it was just, what did they do next? You know, we left them in 2017. What happens next? And usefully for us, unfortunately for a lot of people in the world, the North Korean hackers haven't stopped, according to the accusations against them. In fact, they've doubled down and hit even more targets in even more places in even more innovative and unusual ways. So we really start in immediately, almost in 2018, immediately after that WannaCry attack. And we look at targeting of ATMs and making ATMs spew out money. We look at targeting of cryptocurrency. And obviously, Gene will talk to this, but, you know, in subsequent years, we've not just seen increased cyber activity. We've seen, and this is related, increased military activity around nuclear weapons and missiles.
And I would add that, Jeff, I'm surprised that you say that it was fairly straightforward, because I feel like with season one and season two, we struggled a bit with our timeline. I think, you know, I let Jeff take the lead in deciding which cyber attacks we're going to focus on. And I think in season one, you had a very clear idea that we wanted to focus on the Bangladesh bank heist, which was the core, really, the spine of the narrative. And yet we ended up deciding to go a little bit further back in history and look at the Sony hack. This is season one. And likewise, I think we do a little bit of a turn in season two. You have a strong idea of which cyber attacks are the most important for us to look at. And then I come in and say, but I think we need to look at these certain elements that were happening, things that were happening in North Korea to help us understand. So it's been, hopefully it sounds seamless when everyone listens to season two, but it does start with, we go back to May 2017, which is where we left off with season one. But it was, I would say, kind of a challenge to try to decide which elements we were going to bring into the season. This was true in season one and true in season two, and hopefully we've picked the right elements.
Well, Jeff, you've already hinted at us kind of the fairly dramatic introductory narrative that you hit at in your first episode. And that's this phenomenon, this practice of jackpotting, where you, or some people, not you specifically, hackers, have occasionally learned how to dramatically make ATMs spit out cash. You describe how this was done at one, or actually several, if I recall correctly, kind of black hat conferences in the early 2010s or so. And that then feeds into what seems to be, at least from the first few episodes I've heard, the kind of hub heist, the main heist, which is this Cosmos heist. Tell us a little bit about this practice and how it comes to play a role in this larger heist that gets executed in, I believe, 2018, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, targeting ATMs and cash points, it makes perfect sense for a hacker, doesn't it? It's where the money is, to quote the famous bank robber. But the problem with hacking cash points is, as you said, this has been demonstrated at conferences, notably by Barnaby Jack at the Black Hat conference in Las Vegas, which covering the podcast. The problem is doing it at scale. I mean, yeah, you can go up to cash points and you can try and trick them and you'll get whatever's in the cash point, and that might be in an average ATM, a few thousand, maybe a few tens of thousands, a few hundreds of thousands if you're really lucky. But to make it work at scale, you need to do that for multiple cash points, and that's always been the issue. And the attack we outline, not to give too many spoilers about the episodes, but the attack we outline is where the hackers, the Lazarus Group, are accused of going after Cosmos Cooperative Bank in India, getting inside the bank, and then hijacking the bank's ATM approval software. So basically any ATM withdrawal that comes into Cosmos Bank from any cash point around the world where somebody's trying to withdraw money using a Cosmos card, the hackers can now intercept it and automatically approve it, which, you know, for that scale issue of being able to do these hacks at scale is really important. The problem then is you've then got the issue of, well, you can do that for cash points around the world. So who do you get in different countries around the world to go to the cash points and to make those withdrawals? So there's a higher order problem that the hackers encounter, which is, how do we get people in countries around the world to go to cash points and make withdrawals? And of course, the answer to that is an even more wild and weird story, which we go into in the next couple of episodes in the podcast. But that's, broadly speaking, how jackpotting works and how people have at least tried to do it at scale.
So, Gene, this big heist, this Cosmos heist that forms such a central kind of recurring theme in their narrative that you all carve out in this episode, tell us a little bit about how it fits into the North Korean strategy. Why is this a move that we think it's widely expected, or suspected, I should say, the Lazarus Group was involved in organizing? And what does it tell us a little bit about North Korea's kind of national strategy and how this fits within it?
Overall, I would say, looking at their campaign of cyber attacks, jackpotting being among them, it's very clear that the North Koreans have been plotting a strategy for years on how to take advantage of vulnerabilities in technology and ways to make money that help them get around sanctions. So we should keep in mind that North Korea has been very aggressive with testing ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons, and every single one of these tests is a violation of UN Security Council resolutions and carries with it the risk of even more sanctions. And these sanctions are designed to restrict and limit North Korea's ability to bring in luxury goods and to make the hard currency that it needs to both support the regime and to support the nuclear program. And so I do think that we should consider that they've been taking this into consideration as they've been plotting the acceleration of their program, the nuclear program, and looking for those ways around sanctions. 2018 is so interesting because as these attacks are happening, of course, I was in the middle of just focusing on the diplomacy that was flourishing or blossoming between North Korea and South Korea and North Korea and the United States. And so I think it's very interesting to consider that all of this careful planning and plotting was happening at a time when North Korea was engaged in diplomacy. And so if you're very focused on the diplomacy and thinking that, oh, North Korea's coming out of the cold and they're willing to engage, well, actually, what we want to show you is that they were still continuing some of this activity. The other thing I think that's interesting about jackpotting is, as Jeff mentioned, it required having a network of people all around the world. So this was at a time when they still had an overseas network. And as we'll describe in season two, some of that network does come down a bit because sanctions are designed to kind of tamper and hinder the North Koreans from relying on that overseas network. To me, I found that jackpotting is, I mean, I think that Barnaby Jack, that whole episode is transfixing. And you can imagine being a North Korean thinking, maybe watching a video of him and thinking, how can I get that? How can I do that on a massive scale? But I think it is very interesting for me, because I always think about the fact that they don't have ATMs in North Korea. So any of these technologies, it's hard for us to imagine, hard for me to imagine the North Koreans even conceiving of these crazy schemes because they just don't have that technology on an everyday level in North Korea. So for me, it's also interesting to think about what part of their strategy also requires them to send these people abroad to learn how we bank and to even come up with this scheme and then to carry it out. So that part of it is very interesting to me as well and requires us to think about them, where they come from, where they are, and how that shapes what their strategy is.
So a big theme you hit on in your first few episodes, and I think this carries over from season one in a lot of ways, is the fertile environment in which North Korea is operating, in that they rely upon a lot of external actors, external opportunities, and these exist out in the world as different actors they can engage with, facilitate, cooperate through in different types of activities, whether it's through the dark web or whether it's through a variety of other channels. I think in the first few episodes, this really comes out most distinctly in these two figures with kind of very distinctive names and labels, Hush Puppy and Big Boss. Jeff, can you tell us a little bit about who these figures are? Maybe we'll start with Hush Puppy and then shift to Big Boss. I think Hush Puppy is kind of, that's the chain of causation in a way in this, the way I think of it. Tell us who these guys are and what they, perhaps more importantly, what they tell us about the global system in which North Korea is operating, what they represent in terms of the factors enabling this sort of conduct on North Korea's part.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I would correct you. I think it's probably better to start with Big Boss and then Hush Puppy.
I defer to you, your expertise on this one.
Big Boss is fascinating. So when the North Koreans decide to do these jackpotting attacks on cash points and ATMs, it's not just Cosmos Cooperative Bank in India, by the way. There are others that they try, quite a few others actually, some of which aren't in the news. They need, as we've said, networks of people around the world to go to the ATMs and make those withdrawals. Well, Big Boss provides that. He is a character on the dark web who's got a fairly long history in fraud and credit card abuse, and he makes his skills available to anybody who will pay. And he has a network of what he calls runners, or what are called runners out on the street, i.e. money mules who can go to the cash points, but also he can help with the cloning of the cards, because in order to put cards into ATMs and make withdrawals, you need basically counterfeit cash cards. So Big Boss helps with the creation of those. These are his sort of skill set. So the North Koreans are accused of working with Big Boss on several occasions, several jobs. Goes pretty well. The problem is it gets quite ungainly, that system of, you know, having people all around the world taking out wads of money, and then you've got to get the money back somehow. And so for one of the jobs the North Koreans were accused of doing, they want to do what's called a SWIFT transfer. SWIFT, as listeners of season one will know, is the interbank financial transfer system. Send money from one financial institution to another. So the North Koreans hack into a bank in Malta, is the accusation, and they are going to transfer out some millions of dollars worth of money. They're not going to do the cash point thing they did before. What they want to do is transfer the money out from bank account to bank account, so taking it from the Maltese bank's accounts and sticking it in another account. For that, they need bank accounts. They need laundering accounts they can wash this money through. So they go back to Big Boss and say, hey, you know, can you help? And Big Boss says, well, no, but I know a man who can. And that man is Hush Puppy, who turns out to be an Instagram influencer with something like 2.3 million followers, who's in Dubai and by day is, you know, doing what influencers do, you know, eating in nice restaurants and wearing nice trainers. But by night is carrying out various money laundering activities, including, it then emerges, for the North Koreans. And that leads you to Hush Puppy. So these fascinating characters, this goes back to what Gene said, you know, the North Koreans are looking around the world for accomplices and people to work with. And frankly, they're finding some really weird people, but weird but useful people, because they do help them steal quite a lot of money. I won't do spoiler alert on the full thing, but there's a sad ending for Big Boss and Hush Puppy. But you'll have to listen to the series, season two, to find that out.
Sad for who?
Sad for the men involved, I suppose you could say, yeah.
Well, Gene, tell us a little bit about what these sorts of external facilitators mean for North Korea. I mean, how you mention and highlight the fact that North Korea really relies on being able to send people in the outside world, into the outside world, to develop their strategy, identify weak points, understand how to engage and challenge, digital weaknesses and vulnerabilities in various types of networks in the outside world. And these people seemed like a similar reliance on them. How replaceable are they? How effective is it bringing down these points of pressure? And is that the main focus of the law enforcement strategy in combating these North Korean efforts? Or have we seen that strategy shift to different points of focus over time?
So when it comes to sanctions, these sanctions, both UN Security Council resolution associated sanctions and US Treasury sanctions, have been in place for a long time. But I think it's only in the last few years that we've seen them evolve. And I should say that we've seen US Treasury sanctions evolve to take into account these suspected or alleged hackers. And before that, it was really reliant on trying to stop the flow of money. So really attacking banking. And also to stop people from moving. So one of the key sanctions from the United Nations that we saw was the order to UN member nations to send back the North Koreans who are working in their countries. So that would mean that there would be, hopefully they would say, cutting off the flow of hard currency, the money that the North Koreans were making and sending back to the regime, and also trying to send them home so they're not out in the world. Well, for one, I think the COVID pandemic meant that the North Koreans they shut down their border in January 2020. So a lot of the North Koreans who were overseas did not go back home. They just were not able to get back home. So they're still out there and they're still operating. But also now we've got this whole other realm, cyberspace, that isn't bound by borders. And that's something that the North Koreans have certainly taken advantage of. I think I just thought of this when we're talking about Hush Puppy, who's an Instagram influencer. They can reach people like Big Boss and Hush Puppy through the internet. They're not going to know what an Instagram influencer is if they're in Pyongyang. So they need they may have this opportunity that the dark web and cyberspace offer in terms of connecting with people, but they kind of need to be outside the country and in the world to understand the kind of greed that somebody like Hush Puppy is motivated by, the kind of wealth, the kind of notoriety, because that is not something that they are exposed to inside North Korea. So it requires both of those things. So you have these young men who, and as far as we know, they're young men. I haven't heard of any of these suspected hackers being women, but being out there for years in the world, experiencing life very, not, I shouldn't say similar to ours because they're still under very strict regulations, but seeing how our world works, both in terms of the internet, influencers, banking, all of that, seeing how we live, work, socialize, and becoming very skillful in that. Now, I think that that is a big investment that the North Koreans are making in these people because they're relying on them to understand how we operate. But also, these people cannot get back home right now, as far as we know. And so they're under a lot of pressure to try to make money to support themselves, as well as to make money for the regime. Now, how to stop them? I mean, we get into that later into the season. But clearly, sanctions, if that's going to be a tool that governments or international organizations use to try to stop this activity or slow it down, is going to have to take into account how all of these, not only the North Korean thinking has evolved, their strategy has evolved, technology is evolving. And we're starting to see that, the very start of it. But it's like Jeff and I always call this like a cat and mouse game. It is so hard because they are so invested. North Koreans are so invested in this and they're so clever. They have the time and the resources to really focus on finding that vulnerability. Somebody else I spoke to recently called it whack-a-mole. And that's the challenge that we face, is that they're always going to be looking for a way around the rules that are imposed on them.
Just want to, if it's okay, I just want to come in on the issue about Hush Puppy being an Instagram influencer and how peculiar the North Koreans would have found that. I've been doing a lot of thinking about this, and I do think that I'm not sure whether the North Koreans knew the real identities of the people they were getting involved with, Big Boss and Hush Puppy. Big Boss perhaps a bit more because they were in a bit more touch with him, but Hush Puppy, I'm not sure whether they would have known. But what's certainly true is that when he got arrested, sorry, slight spoiler alert, but when things went wrong for Hush Puppy, the North Koreans would have found out about him and who he was. And as Gene says, I mean, I just cannot imagine what the conversation in Pyongyang would have been like. This guy we were working with, he was a who? He was a what now? He did what on the, wow. Because I don't think they actually would have known about his whole other life as an Instagram influencer. I think they knew he was a money launderer, but that was as far as it went.
He is such a fascinating figure in this whole narrative, undoubtedly, and really underscores a kind of recurring theme that you all hit on, which is the kind of unforced error nature of that has led law enforcement to be able to capture and identify some of these people, not entirely, but that often seems to play a significant role, which is an interesting kind of recurring phenomenon, but probably not that unusual in law enforcement, a lot of other contexts. Gene, you also, in, I think it was the fourth episode of the season, I think it's the last one that's publicly available at the time of recording, you then shift focus to a story that's really different from the cybercrime focus, and that is the Otto Warmbier story that I think a lot of our listeners will be familiar with, which is a really horrible story about a University of Virginia college student who was held captive essentially after visiting North Korea for allegedly trying to steal something, and then ultimately ended up becoming very sick and ultimately dying shortly after returning to the United States. A really heart-wrenching story that I think a lot of people follow very closely. And then you tie it, though, into a broader history, talking about USS Pueblo, a fascinating historical anecdote that I hadn't heard of before that I thought was really compelling in that episode. Tell us a little bit about the relationship you see between Warmbier and the Pueblo, and how that the narrative they support and the what they reflect about North Korea's strategy, how it intersects with the cybercrime activities that is ultimately the focus of the podcast.
It may seem like a bit of a stretch to include those stories, but I do feel that it's important for us to look at these cyber activities in the context of North Korea's overall strategy, particularly Kim Jong-un's strategy. I think we need to make sure that we are looking at these and understanding where North Korea is today, who Kim Jong-un is, what it is he's trying to accomplish, because this cyber activity, we would say, is being done in the name of, in the service of Kim Jong-un. So who is Kim Jong-un? What does he want? What is he thinking? And that was why I wanted to go back to 2017. So again, we left off season one in May of 2017. And so in my head, I was thinking, okay, we need to start and remember where North Korea was, where we were. I mean, I was actually in North Korea at the time, but what was happening in May of 2017? And that year, 2017 was such a, for North Korea watchers, for those of us who pay close attention to what's happening on the Korean Peninsula, we call it the Year of Fire and Fury. It was an intense year. It started really that the testing started in 2016. So in 2016 and 2017, things became very, very tense around the Korean Peninsula because North Korea started, Kim Jong-un started ordering a ramping up of testing. And I think it's really important to recount that year and some of the circumstances, including the Otto Warm Beer story, to understand the kind of tension that was building between North Korea and the United States, and to consider how that may have shaped their motivation in terms of what they wanted to do militarily, and then how they were going to pay for that. Now, I mention the Pueblo because I do think that it's always important to remember that the United States and North Korea are still technically at war. And this is something that often gets overlooked. You know, the North Koreans, the United States signed a truce, a ceasefire in 1953 to sort of bring the fighting of the Korean War to a close, but they never signed a peace treaty. And I mention this because this informs so much of the justification that the North Koreans claim for needing to defend themselves. So I think it's important to look at some of those incidents that highlight and define the fact that the North Koreans play up this tension. And I think that this is something that any American going to North Korea has to keep in mind, that every time we go there as an American, we are at risk of being, and I won't say prisoner of war, although there are prisoners of war in North Korea from South Korea, but that we're always at risk because they see us as the enemy. And it's a really painful time for me to be recounting this when we have a Wall Street Journal reporter detained in Russia, accused of espionage, which is something I was always very concerned about for myself and any American who's in North Korea. And of course, Otto was one of those Americans who was detained at a time when perhaps the North Koreans felt it might be useful to have an American in detention.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name.
And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
So this all raises one of the questions that I think kind of hovers around both the first season and this new season, which is that you have a unique focus on North Korea and the Lazarus Group in particular, but because you follow and chase these streams and intersections with other stories, with other narratives, you get a much bigger sense of the picture of the political context for certain of these actions, of the facilitating context that's allowing some of these criminal activities to undertake. It's what makes it a really compelling listen in a lot of ways, because it is not just one story, but in fact, a bunch of stories being woven together around one thread. But that kind of raises the question to me, Jeff, you know, to what extent is the story you're telling, the main narrative, the North Korea narrative, to what extent is it really just a representative of a much bigger universe? And to what extent is North Korea really a unique actor? Obviously, we know ransomware is a tool used by other criminal groups, other state actors as well. Russia has a kind of notorious relationship with ransomware groups. But is North Korea really exceptional by an order of magnitude from these other actors? Or is this story much more representative of a sort of thing that's happening at a much larger scale involving other actors in the global criminal cybercrime vicinity as well?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, certainly as far as the UK is concerned, I imagine the US and other countries will be pretty similar. North Korea ranks as one of the top four threats in cyber terms to the UK, according to our intelligence agency. So China and Russia generally interchangeably in numbers one and two, and North Korea and Iran interchangeably in numbers three and four, which, you know, for a country where most people can't access the internet, that's quite a position for North Korea to end up in. I always describe it to people as a bit like Doncaster Rovers turning up in the Premier League, which obviously is a joke for people who understand British football, and a joke that's even funnier when you realise how little I understand about British football. North Korea is a really fascinating example to watch, though, because it combines two things that are really important to understand about cyber. It combines nation-state threat, which, as you say, loads of countries have got hackers, they're all doing it, but it combines that with organised financial crime. For all of the reasons Gene's outlined, all of these sanctions, trying to evade sanctions, get money into the country, North Korea is doing financial crime in a way that most governments' hackers aren't doing. That's the accusation against them. And so you get a sort of, you know, for a cybersecurity journalist, a tech journalist like myself, you get a sort of marvelous two-for-one with North Korea. You can look at state hacking and nation-state hacking from a North Korean perspective. You can also look at organized financial crime and cybercrime from a North Korean perspective. They bring the two together. What is interesting about North Korea in terms of how skilled they are and how good they are, clearly they are very good. I mean, they're accused of getting into lots of different organizations. What's interesting is we know about that. We found out about it. They've left the evidence and the trails that lead to the accusations against them. You don't see that so much with particularly China. They're much better at covering their tracks. The North Koreans tend to leave telltale traces. And I think part of that is because they know they can't get arrested at the end of the day. They're in Pyongyang. You know, there's no extradition treaty between Pyongyang and Washington. So they feel safer to kind of do the hacks and then get caught for them, as it were. But secondly, I think there is an element of thinking, well, if people know that we do these hacks, it increases our sort of presence and prowess on the world stage, our kudos on the world stage. So in a way, it's like the art thief who leaves their insignia scrawled on the wall when they've stolen the painting. You kind of want people to know who you did it and who you are. So I think there's an element of that. So in terms of how they are and how they're positioned in terms of global, cyber activity, that's roughly what I'd say.
So Jeff thinks that they're very happy about our podcast.
I do wonder. And there is, Gene, I want to ask you about this, which we've not talked about before. People have asked me, do you think that senior leadership in North Korea and indeed Kim Jong-un, the leader, are aware of the podcast? I don't know whether that's something I've mulled on. I don't know what you think about that.
Oh, absolutely. So for the North Korean diplomats who are abroad, their job is to monitor what we do, to read everything that's being done about North Korea. So they're certainly paying attention. So they're certainly aware. And I do wonder if there's a part of them that doesn't have a sense of pride that we're calling them so aggressive and so skillful and clever and all of this, even as they're angry that we're divulging and shedding light on how their operation works and what their strategy might be. So it's probably a little bit of both, which I think is usually the case for North Korean diplomats abroad, because they are out in the world. They're both proud to represent their country, but also learning something in the process that they may not have known. I was going to just jump and add to what Jeff was saying earlier by saying that, one of the things that I hope we do with the podcast is to show that we can't just be looking at the cyber attacks on their own as the technical prowess and just that tech issue. When it comes to the world we operate in the policy world, if we want to figure out how to restrain the North Koreans from building nuclear weapons, we have to include cyber in discussions around strategy when it comes to trying to stop the flow of money. That hasn't been done so far. It's a bit of a blind spot in the policy community, I think, because people tend to get a little bit overwhelmed by cyber. Just the mention of cyber can turn a lot of people off. So what I'm hoping that we do with the podcast is break down some of these concepts and make it clear that this is not something that only cybersecurity experts need to be aware of, but that we in the policy community need to be aware and well-versed in as well. If we want to think about strategy when it comes to North Koreans, if we want to think about diplomacy, if we want to think about how to partner with other countries, but also to the general public, that we're talking about forms of phishing and vulnerabilities that every single person faces, because every single one of us receives these emails. And so if we can get everyone to think twice about clicking on a link or responding to what seems like a strange Facebook interaction or a suspicious LinkedIn profile, then we've done our job. But I just did want to mention, since you do have a policy audience, to just make that push that we think about these as not just tech issues, but something that needs to be incorporated in discussions about North Korea and about these countries more generally.
But that actually leads into my next question for you quite nicely, Jean. I mean, how much is this podcast, the theme of this podcast, this focus on cybercrime, while you do, you know, dip into other realms of North Korean kind of, I think, what a lot of people in the international community view as malicious activity, hostage taking in the Otto Warmbier case being kind of the leading example in this season, at least so far. You know, how big a chunk of what North Korea is trying to do in the world is the cybercrime agenda? How much of a keystone to its broader strategy is it? And in that sense, is it the key to unlocking, to some extent, a broader strategy against North Korea, an essential part of it? Or is this really a kind of separate strategy that maybe can be addressed independent of the rest of the Korea? It sounds like you think the former, but I'm curious as to why.
I do think that if we want to understand who Kim Jong-un is, that we need to look at his broader strategy around science and technology. And I say that as a journalist who was there on the ground before he came to power, while he was being groomed. And I was there in the early years of his leadership. And so I was subject to all the propaganda. So I was there seeing the building blocks that he was putting into place. And so much of it, he's a millennial, so much of it was around science and technology. And that we should acknowledge that there's some good in that, in the sense that, you know, for North Korea to develop and join the international world in ways that everybody, so many other people, most people in the world are engaged, is fantastic. And yet we should also acknowledge and understand that there's a nefarious side to the strategy as well, that every strategy in North Korea has a domestic purpose and perhaps a foreign policy agenda. And in this case, it involves ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons. So I personally think that we need to look at this and see how it fits into a broader strategy. If we want to understand North Korea, if we want to understand Kim Jong-un and try to gauge which way they're headed and how to stop that program. So, yeah, I mean, I think that one of my frustrations is that it tends to be seen and sidelined as just a tech issue. But my emphasis is always like, this is so woven into the core of his strategy, Kim Jong-un's strategy. And that's what we need to understand if we want to put this in a bigger context when it comes to North Korea and its ambitions.
So we right now can hear the first four episodes, but obviously that's less than half of the coming season, I believe. What else do we have to look forward to? What is over the horizon for folks who tune in this week? What can they look forward to in the remaining episodes? Are there any highlights that you all would particularly urge us to listen out for coming down the pike? Jeff, let me start with you.
Again, not to try and give too many spoilers away for season two, but it'd be no surprise, I think, to your listeners that we look at cryptocurrency and North Korea's attempts, the accusations against it to target the cryptocurrency industry. Most cyber criminals are. Crypto makes a lot of sense for a lot of reasons. It is frankly, the soft underbelly of the financial system at the moment. There are vast amounts of money sloshing about in crypto. I mean, we interviewed people at companies and crypto companies and say, well, how much money are you dealing with? And it's in the billions, you know, and these are companies you've never heard of. There is money sloshing about. They're much less protected than banks, partly because the regulation's not there. So again, as a cyber criminal, makes sense to sort of target them. And to go back to the points we've touched on about sanctions, particularly Gene's covered about sanctions, moving crypto around, large parts of it don't move through the traditional financial system. And so as a sort of sanctions evading mechanism, you know, it's a really fertile piece of territory for countries like North Korea to be exploiting. So no surprises, we go into crypto. If you're not sure about crypto and don't really understand it, don't worry, we will talk you through it. And also there are some amazing twists and turns, notably the story of the Pyongyang cryptocurrency conference, which happened, which is an absolutely crazy story. So that's yet to come in the podcast.
And I will add that I did get to speak to a former North Korean diplomat who really shed light on how the overseas network works in the Middle East. And that was, you know, he's a fascinating person, obviously provided a lot of interesting detail. We couldn't share everything from his story, but I hope that listeners enjoy hearing from a North Korean's perspective, how this all looked, how this all felt. He has some amazing stories, and that was important to me to make sure that we treat the North Koreans like they are real human beings and not just these hidden people lurking in the shadows, because they are among us and they are interacting with us, whether we know it or not. I really also enjoyed speaking to a hockey player who played on the first United Korean women's hockey team at the Pyeongchang Olympics in South Korea. So that was a fun interview as well. And we have more coming up. We've got some experts talking about where all this money is going, which I think is the episode designed to scare everybody into thinking about where the cryptocurrency is headed.
Well, we will have that to look forward to. I know I will be looking out for these highlights as I keep listening to season two. But for now, we are out of time for this discussion. But thank you so much for joining us here today on the Lawfare Podcast, Gene Lee, Jeff White.
Thanks for having us.
Great, thank you.
Now, as promised, here is a preview from season two, episode one of The Lazarus Heist, which is entitled Jackpotting.
Mumbai, India. It's the 14th of August, 2018, a humid and sluggish Tuesday. Outside, traffic calls along in the afternoon haze. Inside one of the city's police stations, Inspector General Brijesh Singh is taking a quick break from fighting crime, because tomorrow is a big day for his team.
15th of August is our Independence Day here. In Pune, we celebrate it. It's a formal occasion where we hold our parades, and on the VIPs gather all kinds of units from army to navy, to police, to paramilitary, everybody participates. It's a great day for us.
So the day before, you're polishing your shoes and shining your buttons and that kind of thing?
I guess.
So not exactly a good time for Brijesh to get news of a major crime.
पुणे के कॉस्मोस बैंक में साइबर अटैक से 96 करोड़ की लूट हुई है. बैंक के वीजा क्रेडिट कार्ड से 21 देशों में 96 करोड़ का ट्रांजैक्शन हुआ. सभी ट्रांजैक्शंस
वी स्ट्रेंजली गॉट टू नो ऑफ द कॉस्मोस बैंक केस फ्रॉम द टीवी. एक्चुअली वन ऑफ माय यू नो जूनियर्स केम रनिंग टू मी एंड सेड दैट लुक देयर्स समथिंग रनिंग ऑन टीवी वेयर दे आर सेइंग दैट देयर हैज बीन अ सम काइंड ऑफ साइबर अटैक ऑन अ बैंक इन पुणे.
The bank in the news is the Cosmos Cooperative Bank. It's one of India's largest banks. It's headquartered in Pune in Maharashtra state, and that is Brijesh's beat.
Much as I love podcasting, I really wish we could show you a video interview with Brijesh. He's got a piercing gaze and impressively thick moustache. He was once described by an online magazine as Mumbai's answer to a Bruce Willis action hero. Oh, and he's also written a political thriller called Quantum Siege. At the time of this attack, he was heading up Maharashtra's cybercrime unit, and that's where he is when he starts hearing these strange news reports.
Punyatil Cosmos Bank's cyber attack झाला आहे. 2 दिवस ATM बंद ठेवण्यात आले आहेत. हा अटॅक.
And we were very surprised because by the time nobody had actually informed us. So it is ironical that we came to know of this not from our own sources, from our intelligence, but from television.
So, Brijesh stops polishing his parade shoes and makes a few calls to the bank. What he hears worries him so much, he decides to ditch the festivities and get on the road.
And then I decided to leave for Pune. Pune is like 150 kilometers from Mumbai. Since it seemed to be such a big attack, I decided to go there to supervise the investigation personally.
Pune. Population 7.5 million. It's a huge industrial centre, famous for its car industry. It's known as India's Motor City. Brijesh makes his way to Cosmos HQ, a modern 12-storey steel and glass complex, to meet the bank's distraught staff.
They were all like shattered. They didn't exactly know how to respond to this.
A strange tale unfolds. The previous Saturday, 11th of August, when not too many people were in the office, urgent messages started to arrive.
There were messages from Visa US regarding abnormal transactions, the sharp increase in transaction during 1 hour, and they were alerting us to go through about the genuineness of these transactions.
This is Milind Karle, chairman of the bank.
If you've listened to season one, what he's saying is probably sounding eerily familiar. A bank in South Asia suddenly getting urgent messages about suspicious transactions. It's what alerted the Central Bank of Bangladesh to the attempted billion-dollar hack that we covered in Season 1. But this time, it's a different story. And it's going to lead us down a very different and even more surprising labyrinth of rabbit holes.
This time, the calls are coming from Visa, one of the world's largest card payments companies. And they're calling from the U.S. to say, hey, you might want to take a look at some suspicious ATM withdrawals connected to Cosmos bank cards. Visa says they can see thousands of demands flooding in for large amounts of cash.
So Milind's team look into it, but when they do, things don't quite add up.
When they said the number of transactions and the value of the transaction is abnormal, we tried to check it at our end. But surprisingly, there were no abnormal transactions at our end. This continued for about half an hour. They were cautioning us and we were reverting back that there are no such transactions.
The bank staff should be able to see these ATM withdrawal requests coming through on their computers, but they can't. Everything looks normal.
30 minutes later, they authorize Visa to stop all transactions from Cosmos bank cards just to be safe.
But that half hour would turn out to be extremely costly. Those messages from Visa were just the first warning signs of a giant, well-coordinated attack. The next day, Sunday, Visa shares the full list of suspect transactions with the bank.
Which were 12,000 transactions.
12,000 transactions. That's 12,000 separate jackpotting incidents from different ATMs.
Police Inspector General Brijesh Singh can hardly believe what he's hearing.
In terms of Indian money, 94 crore rupees had gone, some $14 million. In a single case, it was a huge, huge loss to the bank.
He starts to pick over the traces of what is, effectively, a digital crime scene. The hackers had done their best to cover their tracks. They tried to wipe the data on the bank's computers. But investigators had managed to find some information among the wreckage, which gave a clue as to how and where the hackers got in the first place.
There was some initial compromise through spear phishing. Very targeted emails were sent.
The phishing emails arrived in employees' inboxes and said something like, "You have won a prize, click to claim it." It's an age-old trick for computer hackers, this. But those dodgy emails are still their weapon of choice because, depressingly, they still work.
As they did at Cosmos. Once an employee opened an attached file, their prize turned out to be a virus that took hold of their machine and quickly spread through the bank's networks.
Somehow, this intrusion had allowed the hackers to co-opt the bank's systems from the inside.
So it was basically a very well-thought-of scheme. It seems that the attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
The attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems. Sounds like someone we know, right?
Indeed it does, yes. But at this point, Brijesh is still very far from working out who's behind the attack. And he can't immediately see how it was done. But he does get hold of some very useful info from inside the bank.
We then got the data of withdrawals. Then we found clusters that, okay, these are happening in particular areas.
He can see the precise locations of the cash points where dodgy withdrawals have been made.
Quite a few of them were close by. In Maharashtra state, dozens of ATMs had been targeted. Brijesh starts to realize the scale of the crime he's dealing with. This heist required a lot of people to make all these withdrawals, a big gang, and they're very well organized.
We were very amazed. We were not aware of a money mule network like this.
By locating the cash points, Brijesh can now get hold of CCTV footage from them, showing the exact moment the dodgy cash withdrawals are made. He watches back the tapes. There are dozens of different men, money mules, seemingly in their 30s and 40s, casually dressed in t-shirts and jeans. They walk up to the cash points, stick in the cards, and stuff the cash into bags.
And Brijesh is watching footage of it happening. Sounds like an amazing lead, right? Video footage of the thieves in action? But of course, they know they're on camera, so...
They try and hide from the CCTV camera. They try to wear caps. They try to cover their mouths. They try and disguise their appearances.
Brijesh is going to have his work cut out finding these guys, because the story's about to get even wilder. As the police and bank's teams investigate, they realise the full scale of what's happened. And it turns out, These withdrawals didn't just take place in India. This is an international jackpotting spree.
Somehow, criminals pulled off over 12,000 jackpotting attacks at ATMs in 28 different countries.
And what makes this even more astonishing is the timing. All these withdrawals took place simultaneously in a time window of just 2 hours, 13 minutes. And you've got to realise, these 28 countries are spread across multiple time zones.
India.
Canada.
Bulgaria.
The UK.
The United Arab Emirates.
Turkey.
Japan.
Russia.
The United States.
The attack happened in the afternoon in India. But the dead of night in America, breakfast time in the UK, hackers have managed to compromise hundreds of ATMs and coordinate an army of money mules to jackpot those machines at exactly the same time. It's an extraordinary global flash mob of crime.
How do you coordinate such an international attack? How do you make it work on so many continents simultaneously?
And perhaps equally importantly, who's running it? Well, months before the attack, thousands of miles from India, a British tech company got a sniff that something dodgy was about to go down. They had a fair idea who was behind it.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please be sure to rate and review us wherever you get your podcast. And check out Lawfare's other podcasts, including Rational Security, a casual, lighthearted chat about national security news that I co-host each week with my colleagues Quinta Jurassic and Alan Rosenstein. In addition, be sure to visit lawfareblog.com for our extensive written coverage of national security law and policy issues, and consider becoming a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare to gain access to an ad-free version of this and other Lawfare podcasts, among other perks. This podcast was edited by Jempacha Howell. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.